Angela Davis's Are Prisons Obsolete? Has become a cornerstone text in the prison abolition movement since its 2003 publication. The slim but powerful volume has influenced generations of activists and scholars, including figures like Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, and filmmaker Ava DuVernay, director of 13th. Davis, a former political prisoner herself, who spent 16 months in jail before being acquitted of all charges in 1972, brings both personal experience and scholarly rigor to her analysis. The book's enduring relevance speaks to its prescience. Written when the U.S. prison population had reached 2 million, it anticipated the continued growth of what Davis terms the prison industrial complex and offered a framework for imagining alternatives that remains vital today. What makes this work particularly compelling is how it challenges us to question something most consider inevitable, the very existence of prisons themselves. We take prisons for granted while simultaneously fearing what happens inside them. This paradoxical relationship reveals how deeply prison has become embedded in our social landscape, so much so that most people cannot imagine society without it. When the prison abolition movement emerged in the late 1960s, approximately 200,000 people were incarcerated in the United States. Today, that number exceeds 2 million, with the U.S. claiming over 20% of the world's prisoners, despite having less than 5% of its population. This staggering disparity raises fundamental questions about justice, racism, and the role of punishment in American society. This massive expansion began during the Reagan era of the 1980s, justified through tough-on-crime rhetoric, despite having little effect on actual crime rates. The war on drugs, mandatory minimum sentences, and three strikes laws contributed significantly to this growth. Instead of reducing crime, larger prison populations simply led to more prisons being built, creating a self-perpetuating cycle of incarceration and construction. California exemplifies this trend. Between 1852 and 1955, the state built only 9 prisons, with none opening during the late 1960s or 1970s. However, during the 1980s alone, 9 new prisons opened, doubling California's total in less than a decade. 12 more opened in the 1990s, bringing the state's total to 33 prisons, 38 camps, 16 community facilities, and 5 prisoner mother facilities. This building boom created thousands of jobs and transformed rural economies into prison towns dependent on incarceration for their survival. The prison has become normalized through pervasive media representation, from Edison's first films to Hollywood prison movies and television shows like Oz, Prison Break, and Orange is the New Black, making incarceration seem natural and permanent. This cultural normalization occurs alongside alarming statistics. 1 in 3 Black men aged 20 to 29 were under some form of criminal justice supervision by the 1990s, with Black women experiencing the fastest growth rate among prison populations. The racial disparities in sentencing and incarceration rates reveal the ongoing legacy of systemic racism in the criminal justice system. The prison functions ideologically as an abstract site for undesirables, relieving society from addressing real issues in communities from which prisoners disproportionately come, especially problems produced by racism and global capitalism. Corporate migration destroys local economies and social services, creating perfect candidates for prison, while punishment industry corporations profit from managing prisoners. Private prison companies, commissary services, phone providers, and other contractors have created a multi-billion dollar industry with powerful lobbying interests, gaining financial stakes in prison population growth. This privatization of punishment has transformed incarceration into a profitable enterprise, further entrenching mass incarceration in American society while diverting attention from addressing underlying social inequalities and systemic injustices. The prison system represents a sophisticated evolution of racialized control in America, following a direct lineage from slavery through Jim Crow to mass incarceration. This transformation demonstrates how systems of racial domination adapt and persist even as their outward forms change. While slavery's formal abolition marked a significant legal shift, white supremacy continued through various institutions, from convict leasing to lynching, segregation, and ultimately mass incarceration, each building upon and refining previous methods of control. The transition from slavery to criminalization was swift and calculated. Former slave states enacted black codes with remarkable precision, criminalizing seemingly ordinary behaviors, loitering, unemployment, or gathering in groups when performed by black people. The 13th Amendment's Critical Exception Clause, which abolished slavery except as punishment for crime, provided the constitutional foundation for a new form of bondage through criminal conviction. Mississippi's black codes exemplified this strategy, criminalizing idle and disorderly conduct, terms deliberately vague enough to enable selective enforcement. Alabama's prison demographics tell a stark story. Before emancipation, 99% of prisoners were white. Within years of the Civil War's end, the prison population had become overwhelmingly black, a demographic reversal that revealed the code's true purpose. The convict lease system emerged as slavery's heir apparent, combining economic exploitation with racial control. This system proved even more brutal than traditional slavery. While slave owners maintained some interest in preserving their human property, convict lessees had no such incentive. Companies could work leased prisoners to death without financial penalty, as they paid for groups rather than individuals. The system's scope was vast. By 1888, every able-bodied male prisoner in Alabama was leased to mining companies for up to $18.50 monthly. This forced labor built crucial infrastructure across the South: Georgia's extensive railroad network, Atlanta's prestigious Peachtree Street, and Birmingham's industrial complex of mines and steel mills. These projects, fundamental to American industrial development, represent a hidden history of exploitation rarely acknowledged in economic histories. Contemporary prison privatization mirrors the convict lease system in disturbing ways. Both systems create powerful financial incentives for expanded incarceration and longer sentences. Private prison corporations, like their historical counterparts, profit from maintaining high imprisonment rates. The system continues to disproportionately target black communities, creating patterns of disenfranchisement that echo historical practices. Modern prison labor programs, while less overtly brutal, continue to extract value from incarcerated individuals while providing minimal compensation. Historical abolition movements, whether targeting slavery, lynching, or segregation, demonstrate that seemingly permanent institutions can be dismantled through sustained resistance and organizing. These movements provide crucial lessons for contemporary prison abolition efforts, showing how persistent activism can overcome deeply entrenched systems of control. Without addressing this latest iteration of racialized control, America's democratic promises remain unfulfilled as mass incarceration continues to suppress black political power and perpetuate racial hierarchies established centuries ago. Ironically, the prison itself began as a reform movement, emerging from Enlightenment ideals about human perfectibility and rational punishment. Before prisons became standardized, punishment was primarily a public spectacle. Executions, torture, pillory, and other macabre penalties were designed to affect spectators more than the punished. These public displays often turned into carnival-like events, with crowds gathering to witness the gruesome proceedings that frequently devolved into drunken revelry rather than serving as deterrents. Reformers like John Howard and Benjamin Rush, influenced by Enlightenment philosophy and Protestant theology, argued that punishment carried out in isolation would reform lawbreakers rather than merely exact revenge. They believed that solitude, combined with labor and religious instruction, would lead to genuine spiritual transformation and moral rehabilitation. This marked a fundamental shift from punishment as public spectacle to punishment as private reformation. The term penitentiary originated in England around 1758, initially conceived for housing penitent prostitutes who sought redemption through prayer and work. John Howard's landmark 1777 work, The State of the Prisons, fundamentally reconceptualized imprisonment as an opportunity for religious self-reflection and reform. His investigations of British and European prisons revealed shocking conditions, disease, corruption, and arbitrary treatment, leading him to advocate for systematic reforms based on cleanliness, discipline, and moral instruction. Between 1787 to 1791, Jeremy Bentham published his influential Panopticon Model, a circular prison where inmates couldn't see each other but could be constantly observed by guards they couldn't see. This psychological architecture was designed to compel prisoners to internalize productive labor habits by making them feel perpetually watched. The Panopticon aligned perfectly with developing industrial capitalism's need for a self-disciplined working class, creating what Bentham called a new mode of obtaining power of mind over mind. America became the primary laboratory for full-fledged Panopticon prisons, with Pennsylvania's Walnut Street Jail becoming the first state penitentiary in 1790. Two competing models emerged. The Pennsylvania system emphasized total isolation and silence, while the rival Auburn model from New York allowed congregate labor but maintained strict silence. These religious reformers saw penitentiary architecture as emulating monastic life, believing solitude would allow souls to flourish through contemplation and prayer. Charles Dickens' 1842 visit to Eastern State Penitentiary produced a scathing critique that would prove prophetic. He condemned solitary confinement as cruel and wrong, despite reformers' humane intentions, describing it as immeasurably worse than any torture of the body and a secret punishment that irreparably damaged prisoners' minds. Unlike Alexis de Tocqueville and Gustave de Beaumont, who believed such punishment led to moral renewal, Dickens warned that prisoners would return to society morally unhealthy and diseased. Today's supermax prisons, where African Americans and Latinos are vastly overrepresented, echo the historical penitentiary model but abandon its rehabilitative pretenses. These modern institutions employ sophisticated surveillance technology and extreme isolation that would have impressed even Bentham, but without any of the original reform rhetoric. Unlike early penitentiaries that claimed to restore humanity through isolation and reflection, supermaxes make no pretense of respecting rights or dignity, justifying their harsh conditions as appropriate for those deemed the worst of the worst, a designation that often reflects racial and social biases more than actual behavior. Women have been largely excluded from public discussions about prison expansion, though their experiences reveal how deeply gendered the prison system is. While women typically constitute only about 5% of prison populations worldwide, they remain the fastest-growing sector of the U.S. prison population. This acceleration in women's imprisonment directly connects to the economic shifts of the 1980s that produced the prison industrial complex. Since the late 18th century, imprisoned women have been represented as fundamentally different from their male counterparts. While male criminality has been deemed relatively normal, female criminality has been viewed as aberrant and more threatening to society. Deviant men have been constructed as criminal, while deviant women have been constructed as insane, leading to women's disproportionate confinement in psychiatric institutions and excessive administration of psychotropic drugs in women's prisons. Quaker reformers campaigned for separate women's prisons in the 19th century, not questioning the notion of fallen women, but arguing they could be redeemed through domestic training and all-female staff. This reform movement created feminized imprisonment regimes with cottages and domestic training that actually steered poor and Black women toward domestic service jobs upon release. Black and Native American women experienced imprisonment differently than white women. They were often segregated in reformatories or disproportionately sentenced to men's prisons. In southern states after the Civil War, Black women endured the brutal convict lease system unmitigated by any feminization of punishment. Today, Native American women remain vastly overrepresented in prisons. Women's prisons today increasingly resemble men's facilities as the prison industrial complex expands. While radical prison opposition movements of the 1970s often overlooked women prisoners, contemporary reforms have ironically adopted a separate but equal model that sometimes demands more repressive conditions to achieve gender equality. This perverse equality manifests in demands for equal weapons in women's prisons and even the creation of women's chain gangs in Alabama and Arizona. Sexual abuse has become institutionalized behind prison walls, with widespread leniency toward offending officers. Human Rights Watch found that male officers routinely rape, assault, and verbally degrade female prisoners, using their authority to compel sexual acts. The criminalization of Black and Latino women includes persistent hypersexualized images that justify sexual assaults, with practices like unnecessary gynecological exams and strip searches constituting state-sanctioned sexual abuse. The prison industrial complex represents an intricate network of relationships connecting corporations, government agencies, correctional communities, and media outlets. This sophisticated system challenges the commonly held belief that rising crime rates caused prison population growth, arguing instead that prison construction and increased incarceration are primarily driven by systemic racism and profit-seeking motives. The complex operates through multiple reinforcing channels, from private prison operations to supplier contracts, from surveillance technology to prisoner healthcare services. Rather than replacing the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex maintains a symbiotic relationship with it, often sharing technologies, contractors, and operational approaches. When defense production declined in the early 1990s following the Cold War's end, major companies like Westinghouse, 3M, Honeywell, and numerous former defense contractors strategically pivoted to crime-fighting equipment and prison security systems. A 1994 Wall Street Journal article documented how defense establishments were cashing in by retooling military technology for domestic use, developing products ranging from smart guns with fingerprint recognition to specialized foam that temporarily blinds suspects. Night vision equipment, surveillance systems, and riot control gear previously designed for warfare found new applications in civilian law enforcement and corrections. Throughout U.S. prison history, prisoners have consistently served as potential profit sources, from forced labor to medical testing subjects. Post-World War II medical experimentation on prisoners significantly accelerated pharmaceutical industry development, often with devastating human costs. At Holmesburg Prison in Philadelphia, Dr. Albert Kligman, creator of Retin-A, conducted hundreds of experiments, viewing inmates as acres of skin for dermatological research. Major corporations, including Johnson & Johnson, Dow Chemical, and several pharmaceutical giants, benefited substantially from these unethical tests, which included exposure to radioactive, toxic, and psychoactive substances. These practices continued until new federal regulations finally prohibited using prisoners as research subjects in 1974. The massive prison expansion beginning in the 1980s coincided with widespread economic deindustrialization and systematic welfare program dismantling. As factory closures and automation eliminated millions of manufacturing jobs, creating a vulnerable population without viable employment prospects, the prison system provided a convenient means of concentrating and managing this human surplus. Politicians and media outlets justified increasingly harsh sentencing policies by stoking public fear about crime and safety, despite falling crime rates nationwide. Television networks increased crime coverage fourfold between 1990-1998, even as homicide rates dropped by half nationwide, creating a perception of rising crime that bore little relationship to reality. Private prison corporations like Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, now CoreCivic, and Wackenhunt, now Geo Group, control 76.4% of the global private prison market, operating 150 facilities across 28 states. Texas alone generates $80 million annually from housing out-of-state prisoners in government-owned, privately run jails. The prison economy extends far beyond private prison operators into a vast network of suppliers and service providers. Major corporations from Dial Soap to AT&T, Nestle to Hewlett-Packard generate significant profits from selling products and services to correctional facilities. Even public prisons have become thoroughly saturated with corporate products and services, from food service and healthcare to telephone systems and commissary items, making them significant sources of capitalist profit. This commercialization of incarceration has created powerful economic incentives to maintain high imprisonment rates, regardless of their social costs or effectiveness at reducing crime. The United States has emerged as the dominant force in the global prison economy, exporting not just products and services, but entire systems of punishment and control worldwide. This influence extends far beyond simple architectural designs or security protocols. It represents a comprehensive export of carceral philosophy, management techniques, and privatization models that reshape global approaches to punishment and detention. Turkey's adoption of F-type prisons, directly modeled after U.S. super racks facilities, illustrates the human cost of this expansion. These facilities have sparked intense resistance, including prolonged hunger strikes that have claimed over 50 lives. The F-type design emphasizes extreme isolation and psychological control, hallmarks of the American Supermax model that have drawn international criticism from human rights organizations. Similar facilities have proliferated across multiple continents, with Australia and South Africa among the nations implementing variations of the Supermax concept. The case of South Africa is particularly telling. Despite its transition from apartheid and stated commitment to democratic transformation, the country has paradoxically embraced the U.S. prison model. Private prison corporations like Wackenhut, now Geo Group, have secured lucrative government contracts, effectively transplanting American-style incarceration into post-apartheid South Africa. This development reveals how the prison industrial complex often perpetuates and internationalizes systems of racial control and social segregation while marketing itself as modernization and progress. The economic tentacles of the prison industrial complex reach deep into global markets. International corporations now profit from everything, from prison construction and surveillance technology to food services and telecommunications in facilities worldwide. This commercialization of punishment has created powerful financial incentives to maintain and expand incarceration globally, regardless of its social costs or effectiveness at reducing crime. For anti-prison activists, this global dimension presents new challenges. They must now confront not just individual facilities or national policies, but an interconnected system that ties together global capitalism, state power, and punitive control. Traditional reform approaches, focusing solely on conditions or policies within prisons, prove inadequate against this transnational network of economic and political relationships. Effective resistance requires understanding and challenging how the prison industrial complex functions as both an economic engine and a mechanism of social control across national boundaries. The abolitionist approach requires us to imagine alternatives to imprisonment without seeking prison-like substitutes. Rather than a single alternative system, we need a constellation of strategies and institutions aimed at removing prisons from our social landscape. This means envisioning decarceration through transformed schools, revitalized education, free universal health care, and a justice system based on reparation rather than retribution. Decriminalizing drug use represents a significant component of the abolitionist agenda. This approach must be linked to developing free, community-based treatment programs accessible to everyone, unlike expensive facilities like the Betty Ford Center that cost nearly $19,000 for 30 days, almost twice a minimum wage worker's annual salary. Other decriminalization efforts should focus on sex work and immigration, challenging the incarceration of undocumented immigrants, especially women fleeing sexual violence. Beyond decriminalization, abolitionists must address how to handle those who harm others. Various organizations worldwide offer alternative justice models, from conflict resolution to restorative justice. Scholar Herman Bianchi suggests redefining crime in terms of tort, replacing criminal law with reparative law. The lawbreaker is thus no longer an evil-minded man or woman, but simply a debtor, a liable person whose human duty is to take responsibility for his or her acts and to assume the duty of repair. Creating effective alternatives requires breaking the conceptual link between crime and punishment. We must recognize that punishment through imprisonment isn't an inevitable consequence of crime, but is tied to political agendas, corporate profit motives, media representations, and racial, class, and gender structures. The abolitionist approach questions why criminals are constituted as a class undeserving of civil and human rights, acknowledging that many people are imprisoned not because of crimes committed, but because their communities have been criminalized. The case of Amy Bile demonstrates the transformative power of restorative approaches. Bile, a white Fulbright scholar working in South Africa, was killed by young South African men in 1993. Four men were convicted and sentenced to 18 years, but in 1997, Amy's parents supported their amnesty petition to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. After their release in 1998, two of the men, Easy Nofamela and Tobeko Penny, met with the Biles. Nofamela expressed his sorrow and asked for forgiveness. Remarkably, the Biles hired both men to work at the Amy Bile Foundation they had established. Linda Bile later expressed a lot of love for them and even purchased land for them to build homes. This example illustrates how justice can be reimagined beyond punishment and retribution. By focusing on healing, reconciliation, and addressing root causes, rather than inflicting further harm, we can begin to envision a world where prisons truly become obsolete. Davis's work fundamentally challenges us to question what we consider inevitable in our social structures and institutions. Just as previous generations could not imagine a world without slavery, lynching, or segregation, systems that seemed permanently woven into society's fabric, many today cannot conceive of society without prisons. Yet history repeatedly demonstrates that institutions once deemed permanent and essential can be dismantled through sustained organized resistance and the collective reimagining of social possibilities. The prison abolition movement asks us to recognize how prisons function as warehouses for outdated racist and misogynistic practices that society has otherwise begun to reject. Modern incarceration perpetuates historical patterns of racial control, from slave patrols to convict leasing to Jim Crow laws. The system disproportionately impacts communities of color, particularly Black and Indigenous populations, while failing to address the root causes of harm and violence in society. The movement challenges us to critically examine how prisons have become our default response to social problems, from mental illness and drug addiction to poverty and homelessness. Rather than addressing these issues through education, healthcare, housing, and economic opportunity, we have chosen a system of punishment and isolation. This carceral approach not only fails to prevent crime or promote rehabilitation, but often exacerbates the very conditions that lead to harmful behaviors. The movement calls for developing new institutions and approaches that address harm without reproducing cycles of violence. This includes investing in community-based solutions, restorative justice practices, mental health services, addiction treatment, and education. It means creating systems focused on prevention and healing rather than retribution and isolation. Examples include community mediation programs, violence interruption initiatives, and transformative justice processes that bring together those who have caused harm with those who have been harmed to find collective solutions. By questioning the fundamental assumptions underlying our punishment system, Davis invites us to imagine and create a more just world, one where prisons truly become obsolete. This vision requires us to confront uncomfortable truths about our society's reliance on incarceration while working to build alternative structures that promote genuine safety, healing, and accountability.